This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross, who, as it happens, is our first guest. Here's what happened. Earlier this month, Terry was interviewed by Mark Maron, the stand-up comic and podcast host, on stage at BAM, the Brooklyn Academy of Music. It was part of the Radio Love Fest series, which BAM presented in partnership with public radio station WNYC. Terry had interviewed Maron twice on Fresh Air and is a fan of Maron's comedy. On his IFC TV series Maron, he plays a version of himself who, like the real Mark Maron, hosts a podcast from his garage in which he interviews comics, actors, directors, and musicians. This was the first time the two met in person, as opposed to speaking to each other from separate studios.
I'm a little nervous, but I've prepared. I've written things on a piece of paper. I don't know how you prepare. I could ask you that. Maybe I will, but this is how I prepare. I panic for a while,
yeah.
And then I scramble, and then I type some things up, and then I handwrite things that are hard to read so I can, you know, challenge myself on that level during the interview.
Being self-defeating is always a good part of preparation.
What is?
Being self-defeating.
Yes.
Self-sabotage.
Yes.
Key.
Right. So you do that?
I sometimes do that.
How often?
I try not to do that. I do that more in life than I do in radio.
Really?
Yeah.
Like today?
Life is harder than radio.
Life is harder than radio.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
My experience with you is only with voice. This is the first time I've seen you moving. I think for a while there, pre-inter, that there was no pictures of you available anywhere. Like when I didn't really know what you looked like, but just your voice made me want to be a better person.
Have I accomplished that? Have I accomplished that?
Yeah, I think so. I get nervous. Like, you know, like talking to you now is good. I feel like, you know, because I don't know why you interview, but for me it's to get very deep emotional needs met. So, like, I seem to be getting along with you. We're connecting. It makes me happy. It doesn't feel difficult to me. I know you're wondering how this is going. I'm telling you from my point of view that I'm having a nice time. Now,
so am I.
But when I'm in the studio talking to you, I'm like, I'm standing up straight. And you know, I want to impress you. Like, one time I made you snort laugh, and I was like, I win. I heard you laugh and snort, and I'm like, I'm done with radio. I can wear that as a badge of honor. But it's sort of interesting to me, somebody who is, you know, that aware of, like, you know, what you think people think about you or what you're saying, you know, that you didn't want to be seen, that, you know, your voice, you were brought up Jewish, right?
Yeah.
Where?
Brooklyn.
And where was it specifically?
It was in Sheepshead Bay, Brooklyn. And for anybody who knows Senior's Restaurant, what used to be Senior's Restaurant, they were my backyard.
Really?
On an apartment building,
uh-huh.
Like a series of apartment buildings. And what's interesting is that I grew up in a family that thought that we shouldn't share things about the family. Like,
with the family? Or?
No, outside the family. Like, You keep that inside. And so there was an article about me that was written for Philadelphia Magazine years ago. And the gist of the article was, like, people don't know much about her. They don't know who she really is. One of the people on my staff was quoted as saying, like, she's really great. I really like working with her. I don't know a thing about her. And so my mother took the article and said, you shouldn't have told them all of this. And she said something like, I don't even want this in my house. And I was like, Mom, the article is about how, like, nobody knows anything about me. You know? So it's kind of ironic that, you know, what I do for a living is try to help people share things about themselves that might be of value to other people.
Did you always think about it like that, though? Before we get there, though, why were they so wary of people knowing something about the family? I mean, what, was your father running around yelling all the time?
Well, there was a little bit of that.
Yeah? But, how much?
Well, he wasn't shy about his opinion, let's put it that way. But I mean, among the things that I think kept them feeling like you keep things to yourself was, okay, anti-Semitism, the Holocaust, McCarthyism. My father, before he became involved with a family business, was a union leader, like a small part of the union.
Like in the 30s?
This would have been in the 40s, probably. Uh-huh. 40s or early 50s.
So he was justifiably nervous on some level.
So, like, there was a lot that, like, people weren't supposed to know about.
Right. And you grew up in a sort of very kind of pivotal time of change, and things were very exciting.
Yeah.
I mean, you were 19 in 1969
right.
or so.
Right, yes.
Now, when you were younger, I mean, what was the dream? I mean, what were you doing?
Well, when I was in high school, I wanted to be a lyricist.
Like for songs?
For songs.
But what made you want to do that? What songs?
Well, it's more like in Brooklyn, some of the audience here might remember, or they might still do it, I don't know. Brooklyn schools, public schools, used to have something called Sing, mm-hmm. where you'd put on a show. Each grade would put on a show at the end of the year, and you'd write your own storyline. You'd borrow melodies from Broadway shows and write your own lyrics. Mm-hmm. So I was one of the lyricists for each year while I was there. And part of the time I was in high school, my friends shared this like interest in theater, and it was great. And I thought, like, if I could live that life where there's theater and there's song and there's music and there's people designing scenery and painting it, and like, that would just be super. And then I thought, yeah, and how do you get there?
Yeah.
Like, how the hell do you get there?
Right.
But it was kind of thrilling if somebody sang a lyric that I wrote. Like, once I was walking down the street and I heard a couple of, like, the basketball players singing a lyric I wrote. And I thought, like, that is just
power.
Fabulous.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
Do you remember the lyric?
No.
Really?
Yeah.
You don't?
I'm lying. I wouldn't tell you.
You wouldn't?
No.
That's what
I have
you will
my
tell
limits.
Me?
Yeah.
That's where you draw the
That's
line?
That's where I draw the line.
At a lyric that some basketball players were singing? That's what you don't want America to know about you?
Yeah.
You're afraid they'll judge you? Terry Gross wrote that horrible lyric.
Yeah, yeah.
When she was 14.
Yeah.
I'm not listening to Fresh Air anymore.
That's, you nailed it, Mark. You absolutely nailed it.
Why is that embarrassing to you?
Because it is. Because it wasn't good.
You were a child.
Yeah.
Okay. Bye. Thanks. What else did you do in high school?
What else did I do in high school?
Not a cheerleader, I'm assuming. If you.
No, I was a booster, actually.
What does that mean?
It means that you sit and holler in the stands. You do cheers. You get a cool jacket,
yeah.
and you sit and holler in the stands, and it was, you know.
Do you get a thing?
Nah.
No. I don't. I just did
you
that.
You yell the cheers and.
And you got a jacket.
You got
said?
A jacket. Yeah.
But you so you're trying to fit in by being a booster. Is that what was going on?
Well, it seemed like fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you knew how to have fun.
That's a good question. Do I know how to have fun?
Did you then, and do you now? Sure. Let's
I don't
expand
know.
It.
Yeah, it's not my. It's not probably what I'm most famous for. You know, I'm probably, you know, in some ways better at working than I am at, like, relaxing.
Right. But do you know how to have fun? And
yeah, maybe.
What do you do for...
For fun? I go to the movies, uh-huh. go to concerts.
Uh-huh.
And can I get a chance to ask you a question?
In a minute. I know how that goes. I'm trying to hold the line, Terry. These are professional boundaries. I'm the questioner.
Okay.
But like I'm sort of a. So how are you with Joy? I'm asking this because this is all I know. Look, you know, we do. You know, I became an interviewer for reasons that had nothing to do with interviewing. I ended up there, and you know, I know what my emotional why I do it and how I ended up here. So like right now, personally, I'm wrestling with, and I don't know if you feel this way, you say you work all the time, but you talk to people professionally and, you know, you elicit things from them and you draw people out. And for the reason you said before is to make lives better by kind of letting people tell who they are. But do you get something out of that emotionally? Because I find in my life that I'm capable of a almost deeper intimacy with.
That was the question I was going to ask you.
Well, I'm asking you first.
Okay. Yes.
Looks like I beat you to it, which just means that I'm learning. Yeah, I just feel like I had one of these weird kind of like, yes, I'm glad that I'm on the same right track. That if I came up with that question that you already had in your mind. Do you?
Well, it's a weird thing. You know, I'll give you an example. Like, I often ask people who have a history of illness or who are near death, because I've interviewed people who are near death, I've asked them very intimate things about facing death and about their attitudes toward death. I ask people a lot how they want to be buried, or if they want to be buried, if they prefer to be cremated. Mm. I had a friend a couple of years ago who was also a neighbor who died, and I spent a lot of time with her at the end of her life, in helping, like shopping for food for her, making some food for her. And I knew she didn't want to talk about facing death, and she was really not ready to do it. I mean, to the end, she didn't want to talk about it. And so here I am talking to people who I'm not in the room with, like you said. I don't know them, they don't know me, and I'm asking them about death. And here's my friend who's dying, and I'm not talking with her about death. But there was a reason for that, and I felt it would have been intrusive in a way that it's not with my interviewees, because she was not ready to talk about it.
And also the experience you were having was, you know, you were there for her.
I was there to be protective and to give her what she needed. And what she needed, or at least what she thought she needed, wasn't to talk about that.
Was your curiosity, you know, are you curious for yourself, or do you want to know how they're handling it? I mean, how much of this is driven by your own curiosity for answers for your own life?
Oh, a lot of it.
Yeah.
A lot of it. You know, people always say they want to find out what makes other people tick. I always feel like I want to find out what makes me tick.
Right.
And I've just like learned a lot about myself and about people in general by having the liberty of asking people very personal things. But I do it selectively. Like, I ask people personal things who I think are ready for it, mm-hmm. and who can handle it.
How do you determine that?
Well, they're usually on the show for a reason, and often the reason is that they've written a memoir, or there's someone like you who uses your life as the material
right.
that you draw in what you do,
yeah.
comedy. Your comedy comes so directly from your life. Your stand-up,
yeah.
your show,
yeah.
who do you play on your show? A version of yourself.
Yeah, that guy.
So with you, I feel like I can ask you probably anything,
yeah.
and you'd probably answer, and if you didn't, you'd know how to handle it.
Yeah.
If you didn't want to answer it, you'd know how to get around it.
I don't know if that's true.
Really?
Well, I'd know how to get around it, but like, it would probably be like so blaringly obvious that I was just sort of like, I don't know if I want to deal with that.
I'd accept that as an answer.
But would you cut that? You would cut that.
It depends.
What the tone of it was?
We would cut it if we were trying to protect you, but if you did it in a way that you wanted out there, mm-hmm. where we wouldn't feel like we were violating you by mm-hmm. putting it out there, we'd put it out there as like, you're proud to say, here's what your limits are.
Have you had experience with that where, you know, you've made that call and you were wrong and you violated somebody?
I don't think so.
Is there anyone that won't do your show ever again, or you won't talk to you?
No, I don't. My producers are in the audience, so maybe they can think of somebody. No, we've had publicists who said...
They're sitting there going, like, she doesn't even know.
Maybe. That is maybe true.
We don't tell her that. Why'd you bring that up? So.
But can I ask you a question? So a lot of your friends are comics.
Yeah.
Right? And so I'm assuming, like, when comics get together...
Yeah.
...that they don't share intimate thoughts and talk about their lives and...
Yeah.
But you talk to people about really personal stuff on your show.
Yeah.
When you're doing your podcast and you're interviewing people, do you go places you don't with your friends? You know, because it's...
Well, I know what you're doing.
Do you mind?
Do I mind?
Yeah, if I ask you?
No. No, I mean, like, I sometimes I don't know what's socially appropriate and what isn't, even with friends. And if I need to talk about something, usually the way I do it, like, if you want to learn some tricks, is you know, if I go ahead and volunteer some information, there's some part of the brain that's sort of like, oh, I can top that, or I've done that, or, you know, so like comics do talk about life. They just talk about it in sort of a rough way or a crass way. But
right.
most of them, you know, most of the comics I know, you know, we do talk about that stuff. And not unlike, you know, whoever your friends are, you know how to operate. You know how your friends work eventually.
Right.
And you learn how to talk about those things with them. And
right.
you know where their
right.
boundaries are. And
right.
You know, there's
right.
no reason to... I've pushed a lot of people away by being, you know, needy and nervous.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you?
You mean in real life or on the air?
No, in real life. Do you have friends?
I do, but it's almost like theoretical. It's almost like an abstraction because I never seem to have time to see them.
You have abstract friends?
I mean, I have people who I love in my life, and I have a husband who I love very much, and we've been together like since like 1978.
That's
the staff I work with, I mean, I work with people like our executive producer. We've worked together since 1978.
Danny?
Danny, yeah. And a
How'd
lot of
you
people
meet that
on the
guy?
Show. And a lot of people on the show I've worked with for years, and they might disagree. I feel very close to them.
How could you not? You're with them more than anybody.
Yeah, we spend a lot of time together, and it feels to me like a very close set of relationships.
Does your husband ever talk in this tone? How's Danny?
No, he likes Danny a lot. No.
Does he talk? Your husband? Does he talk?
Does he talk? Oh yeah, he talks. He writes. He's a professional writer.
He's a writer. He writes a jazz critic, right?
He's a jazz critic. Yeah.
So he's writing about music. So
he writes about music and other things. And
does this happen in your house? Does your husband? What's your husband's name? Francis, right? Your husband's name?
Francis Davis.
Francis Davis. Does he go? Does he say, Terry, come in here and dig this swing? Does he?
No, but he does say, I really want to play this track for you. Yes.
Do you have time?
For music?
No, that was the next thing he says. Can you spare me a few minutes?
Yeah. No, one of the things we do Saturday mornings when we have breakfast is we choose a record that we want to hear.
And you just enjoy it?
Well, while we're eating and talking and listening, yeah.
Like you make, this is a routine you have?
Yeah, it's
like
a routine every Saturday morning.
Music time?
Yeah, well, we each have our own music time too, but that's our like music together time.
But and then you eat breakfast?
While we're listening.
While you're listening?
Yes.
Does Francis ever just sort of like go, ugh, that this, you know, I'm making a character for your husband. I don't know. But what I'm saying, is he ever like, I don't like this one.
Here's what typically happens. He spends a lot of time in record stores looking for unusual and interesting
So he's a vinyl
things.
Guy.
Well, our house is like, it's kind of like we're living in a record store in
Lumber. Oh, so now we're talking. So he's got... There's just stacks of records everywhere. Because I know the vinyl addiction.
Records and CDs and...
So do you walk around the house going, are you kidding me?
Yes.
I can't get into the bathroom.
It is a little like that.
Oh,
it
okay.
is a little like that.
So...
But anyway, so
no,
he's...
No. So...
Is your house like that?
Is my house... Let's stay at your house. So...
No. My house is like a little apartment.
That's how I pictured it. Like, every time I talk to you on the air, I always picture you like in some weird bunker surrounded by books.
It's kind of like that.
Like, you have your own ISDN line. And
I don't have that.
You should get that. Why don't you get that? There's probably no room for that.
Yeah, right.
So, what do you have? So, I picture you have like hundreds of books, hundreds of thousands.
We have a lot of books. We have... I try
no,
not to take
No, he has records.
Home.
What do you have?
I try not to take stuff home anymore.
From the station.
Yeah, because
it keeps coming.
There's no room. There's just no. We're just like we're maxed out.
Really? Are you like hoarder maxed out? Are you like doing this down the hallway? Come on.
It's
what, Terry?
It's getting close. No, I mean, we have a lot of stuff, books and records and CDs.
Uh-huh.
But anyways, so...
So, how much time do you spend at work versus how much time you spend, you know, in the record pit?
I'm usually in the office by around 8:30.
In the morning?
In the morning. I leave around 6.
Uh-huh. And
then
that's every day?
It's every weekday. And then my husband and I usually go out for dinner.
Every night?
Yeah, just about every night.
No cooking at home.
I'm too tired to cook. He hates to cook. I mean, he doesn't know how to cook. It's not an issue.
He doesn't know how to cook.
No, I mean,
he's just sitting at home listening to records all day.
listening, writing, reading.
Sure.
Not cooking. Doing things that are not cooking.
Does he shop at least? I mean, come on.
Like, for food, we go to the supermarket together.
Why can't he do it himself? What's he doing all day?
Writing, listening.
All right, all right. I don't buy it. So you go out to eat every night, and then you do the music thing on Saturdays. That's nice. It sounds like you have nice time, nice relationship.
We have a great relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And no children.
No.
And that's okay.
That's
right?
Intentional.
Okay.
Well, speaking for myself.
I don't have any either.
I know you do. And
I don't.
I mean, I know you do not. I know you really do. No, I know you don't. No, growing up in Brooklyn, when I was growing up, all the women I knew were basically full-time mothers.
Mm-hmm.
Or they were in the few professions that allowed women at the time. Mm-hmm. You know, secretary, clerk, working in your husband's office,
mm-hmm.
Nurse, teacher. And I just knew I didn't want to be, I wanted a different life. I wanted out. I wanted out of the neighborhood. I wanted out of that life. I didn't want that life.
But at that time, why do you think that was?
Well, why didn't I want that life?
What was it that like looked so unappealing? What did you realize at that time that many people don't even realize now?
I wanted interesting work. I wanted to fall in love with work, and I wanted to fall in love with a person. And, you know, I'm lucky I had both.
And was your husband your first love?
Now that I really know what love is, I'd say yes.
Hmm.
But
what was the other thing?
Well, I mean, this gets really personal. I mean, I was married before, and
for how long?
A short time, and we were very close, and it was a year maybe.
A year.
I don't.
Right, how old were you?
It was a very close relationship.
Let's
and
relax a little bit.
And it makes me nervous to talk about.
How old were you with the first
I was name? Very young. Oh, we were still in college.
Like 19, 20?
Yeah, it was the era, yeah, I was 20 maybe, 19, 20.
Where'd you meet that guy?
Oh, we actually knew each other from high school.
Really?
Yeah,
so
but
you
not
had,
well.
And you met him, he went to college at the same college as you?
Yeah.
And this was the 60s?
Yeah.
And you thought you fell in love?
Well, we did, I suppose.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you got married quickly, or?
We got married quickly. I don't know, we'd already been living together for a while. It didn't seem that
quick.
Oh,
up there at college?
You know, time seems different when you're young. Like
sure.
A year is like a really long time.
Yeah, yeah. How did your parents know about that?
Yeah, they did.
They were okay with it?
They were okay as parents were at the time. My parents weren't okay with anything I was doing then.
Why
in my sophomore year, instead of going to college, we hitchhiked cross country.
You and this guy?
Me and this guy.
Where's this guy now?
In New York.
Oh, you know him still?
We haven't been in touch in a long time, but...
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, surprise, we happen to have him.
No, he's a wonderful person. I mean, I have nothing but... He's really a wonderful person.
I'm just you have to understand that. Like, you know, a lot of us have created a life for you, Terry, and this is all, this is exciting information. This is what we're, we can, you know, be funny and just brush over stuff all night long, but this is exciting stuff to me.
Well, my parents, when I decided to hitchhike cross country, they were very, very upset about it.
I'm upset now.
Well... Now that I'm the age that I am,
yeah.
I think like, my gosh, no wonder they were so upset. But my attitude then was, you know, you're not telling me what to do.
Right.
It's like, you don't control me anymore.
Yeah, that's right. It's 1960 whatever. And,
nine?
You know, we had nine, and what do
yeah.
parents know? Like, that must have been part of your brain at that time, the culture shifting and parents representing what they were representing. It sounds like your parents were, you know, somewhat progressive, but definitely middle class and had expectations.
Right, yeah, yeah. And
so
this was not their expectation that I would, like, drop out or...
Was this a big deal for you? Was it against character?
It was totally against character. And the fact is that I think my boyfriend wanted to do it probably more than I did because I'm really... not the adventurous type. I think I'm like intellectually adventurous. I'm adventurous in my musical taste, in my artistic taste.
Sure.
I'm not a physically adventurous person.
Right.
I'm not a risk taker when it comes to the outside world.
When it comes to being outdoors.
When it comes to Yeah.
Right.
Like
no,
life
I get
itself.
It. But so you know that about yourself now,
yeah.
But this must have been a fairly powerful bit of business for you personally.
It was, and it was weird. I mean, I hitchhike rides, like, there was somebody who was probably just out of prison and somebody else who was probably had tuberculosis, judging from how he was coughing. And in the back of a truck with probably, there were probably migrant workers, and there were axes all over. I don't think they planned on using them against us. But it is a kind of creepy feeling to be in the back of a pickup truck where there's axes. And if my ex-boyfriend husband is listening to this, I hope his memories jive with mine about these rides, because I can't swear to the accuracy of my memory, but it was just totally creepy.
I'm amazed at how vivid your memories are of this major event in your life that you were perfectly willing to toss aside a moment ago. Now,
but it was very upsetting to me because my parents were so upset, and I love my parents dearly, and it broke my heart to know how distraught they were. They tried everything. They flew up to Buffalo before I left and begged me, don't go.
On the trip.
On the trip.
The hitchhiking thing.
And I did this whole, I've got to do what I've got to do, and you can't tell me. But my heart was breaking because it's like, I don't want to hurt them. But at the same time, I felt like I had to cut the string.
Right.
You know, and that if I gave in, that it would always feel to them like, she's our good daughter, everything's under control. And I just had to do it. My parents had such good reasons
to be
afraid.
But also in retrospect.
But I have no regrets about doing it.
Right. Did, once you got back safely and, you know, was there, did it get okay with your parents? Were they, or did you marry the guy right when you got back as part of the same momentum to sort of say, I'm my own person? And
I mean, we loved each other. It mm-hmm. was a beautiful relationship. Mm-hmm. We were, you know, it was good.
Mm-hmm. Just didn't work out.
Well, you know, at some point, we were living, even when we got married, we were living with a group of people. And, because it was the 60s and 70s, and like, it was, you know, people shared, you know, the housework and the cooking. And at some point I thought, no, and that's where it ended. Yeah. And
for you, or in general?
No, no.
It was not that kind of thing.
It was not that kind of thing.
A lot of people,
yeah.
You know, hairy people. probably not a lot of showering going on. Some, like, a lot of healthy food-ish.
Healthy food-ish.
One really good-looking guy who was sort of the leader.
Well, a couple of our roommates ran the health food restaurant, the macrobiotic health
food
restaurant. Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh, so it was all connected.
It was all connected. But anyway, so at some point I realized, you know what I really need? You know what I really, really need? I need to live alone. I need to find out who I am.
Oh, good.
Outside of the group.
Right.
Outside of a marriage. I was too young
to be
committed. Is what it really was.
Yeah.
And
you
I needed to know myself.
Right.
And I needed to know, and I think a lot of women go through this, and I think coming of age, when I came of age, you know, and I started college in 1968, it was kind of understood, like, you grow up, you get married, and you have children, and even if you have a job, that's the trajectory. And like I said before, I knew I wanted a different life, and I knew at some point that to have that life, I needed to know who I was. And without picking up on what other people wanted of me or asked of me or projected on me or any of that. And that required just having some room totally by myself, which I'd never had in my life.
Terry Gross and Mark Maron recorded on stage at the Brooklyn Academy of Music earlier this month. Their interview was part of the Radio Love Fest series presented in partnership with the public radio station WNYC. You can hear all of our original broadcast of Terry's interview on our podcast or at our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, David Letterman's longtime producer and former intern, Rob Burnett, discusses the end of The Late Show. This is Fresh Air Weekend. Last Wednesday night, after 33 years on television as a late-night talk show host, David Letterman presented his final program. Today, we salute Letterman by visiting with his longtime executive producer, Rob Burnett, who's worked with Letterman since 1985 when Burnett was an intern. He became the head writer of Late Night with David Letterman in 1992 and continued as head writer when Letterman moved from NBC to CBS. In 1996, Burnett became the executive producer of The Late Show with David Letterman, a position he kept through the finale. He remains the president and CEO of Letterman's production company, Worldwide Pants. Terry spoke with Burnett last Tuesday when there were still two broadcasts remaining. Let's start with a clip from the Wednesday night finale. It's the last top 10 list, with each joke performed by a different celebrity and frequent Late Show guest. We've edited the clip for time.
Top 10 things I've always wanted to say to Dave. Number 10, Alec Baldwin.
Of all the talk shows, yours is most geographically convenient to my home.
Number 9, Barbara Walters.
Dave, did you know that you wear the same cologne as Muammar Gaddafi?
Yes. Number 8, Steve Martin.
Your extensive plastic surgery was a necessity and a mistake.
Number 7, Jerry Seinfeld.
Dave, I have no idea what I'll do when you go off the air. You know, I just thought of something. I'll be fine.
Number 6, Jim Carrey.
I've always found you to be a bit of an overactor.
Number 5, Chris Rock.
I'm just glad your show is being given to another white guy.
Number 4, Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Thanks for letting me take part in another hugely disappointing series finale.
Number 3, Peyton Manning.
Dave, you are to comedy what I am to comedy.
Number 2, Tina Fey.
Thanks for finally proving men can be funny.
Things I've always wanted to say to Dave. Number 1, Bill Murray, ladies and gentlemen.
Dave, I'll never have the money I owe you.
Oh, no.
Rob Burnett, welcome to Fresh Air. Were you around when the top 10 list was started?
I was there when the top 10 list was invented, although I was not yet on the writing staff, so I was not, I was not in the room.
You were an intern?
I may have been a talent assistant at that point. In 88, I became a writer on the show, which was really the dream that I had always had. And then in 92, when I was 29, somehow became head writer of the show and then kind of went from there. But yes, I was around when the top 10 began, and I think, like most things, no one ever really thought it would become what it would become. It was just a silly parody idea to make fun of other top 10 lists.
So how did it catch on? How did you know this was going to be a thing?
Well, people responded to it, and it actually became kind of an interesting way to write topical jokes every day. It was an interesting form. Originally, you know, the first one was very silly, top 10 things that kind of rhyme with peas, very Letterman-esque. I remember when I was a writer, just a staff writer, Jerry Mulligan and I were pushing for a long time and finally got through a list that was top 10 ways the world would be different if everyone were named Phil, which was one of my favorites. It was so dumb. It was things like, you know, Ben and Jerry's, now called Phil and Phil's. You know, it couldn't have been stupider, you know. Favorite Beatle, Phil. It was just 10 of the stupidest things possible, and some of those were ultimately my favorites.
One of the ways you worked your way up the Letterman staff was writing jokes for Dave. So do you remember the first jokes that he actually accepted?
I do. The first joke, I'll back up a touch. The first joke that I ever got on TV actually was not for Dave. One of the writers, a guy named Larry Jacobson, was extraordinarily kind to me and introduced me to a comedian named Will Schreiner. And Will used to buy my jokes for $25 a piece if he used them. And I wrote a joke for him that he went on to The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. And the joke was simply, oh, now that I'm a big star, my wife is worried that it's going to go to my head, but I had my people call her and tell her not to worry. And Johnny, yeah. And Will was doing that sitting next to Johnny, and Johnny laughed out loud and said, "That's funny." And this was a moment that I will never forget. I was in Brooklyn with my two roommates in some horrible apartment, and we're all high-fiving each other. Johnny Carson thinks I'm funny. It was just, you know, it was a career moment that I will never forget. From there, Dave allowed me to start submitting jokes for his monologue, which I don't think was a particular strong suit of mine, but I did write them. And the first joke that I ever got on the show, unfortunately, is so topical that it barely makes sense. But I, of course, I do remember it. And in fact, I have the cue card at home. But I do remember an early joke that I the joke that I'm probably most proud of that I wrote for Dave's monologue, and a joke that he had done many times over and over again. It was simply a joke that was Dave saying, I was coming to work today, and a guy came up to me and said, oh my God, I've watched you every night for the last 25 years. And I say, oh, great, what's your favorite part of the show? And the guy says, oh, you've got a show?
So how involved were you with the pranks on Letterman's show, like the stupid pet tricks, the throwing stuff off the roof?
Well, stupid pet tricks, not incredibly involved in that particular segment. That really comes through our talent department. We have someone dedicated to that, finding tricks. Dropping things off a building, I did my fair share of. I remember particularly one day at the Ed Sullivan Theater holding a bowling ball in my hand and dropping it into a bathtub full of pudding and thinking, I am the luckiest man alive.
So what do you need, like, permission from the city to do that, or do you have to close off the street?
No, we just tell people to duck. No, of course we have permission. Of course we close off the street. We're dropping bowling balls from the roof of the building. What do we think? Hey, heads up, everybody. Heads up. Put your briefcase over your head. Here comes a bowling ball. Here comes a giant mannequin. No, yes, the city's been cooperative. I think they realize Dave's contribution to New York, and they've always worked really well with us.
The Letterman show has had some pretty serious things it's had to deal with. 9/11, that was a really big event, of course, in the life of our nation and of New York City, and in the life of the Letterman show. When Letterman came back for the first show after 9/11, you know, deciding to bring the show back and deciding what the tone would be, and his really sober monologue about what it meant to be in New York, it was so moving. Let's hear a short excerpt of that opening monologue. And this was recorded September 17th, 2001.
I just want to go through this, and again, forgive me if this is more for me than it is for people watching. I'm sorry, but I have to go through this. The reason we were attacked, the reason these people are dead, these people are missing and dead, and they weren't doing anything wrong. They were living their lives. They were going to work. They were traveling. They were doing what they normally do. As I understand it, and my understanding of this is vague at best, another smaller group of people stole some airplanes and crashed them into buildings. And we're told that they were zealots fueled by religious fervor. And if you live to be 1,000 years old, will that make any sense to you? Will that make any sense?
An excerpt of David Letterman's opening monologue when the show came back after 9/11. And Rob Burnett, my guest, is the former head writer, executive producer of the show. So what was it like after 9/11 to figure out what to do on the show?
It was extraordinarily difficult. It felt ridiculous to be doing a comedy show, probably at all, but particularly in New York City. Nobody knew what to do, not us, not any of the other shows. It just felt ridiculous. And this is, you know, where Dave has, you know, and as he said in that opening monologue, that, you know, he says, I don't trust my own judgment in these things. Well, I sure do. You know, he always kind of knows what the right thing to do is in those kinds of situations. It was very difficult, but I thought Dave did an incredible job, and he is so trusted and he's so honest as a performer that I think people really enjoyed. I think he made people feel better. We still get letters from people that were directly affected by 9/11 that show meant something to them. And how wonderful is that?
So in a span of less than 2 years, Letterman has bypass surgery and 9/11 happens. Both things had a really big impact on the tone of the show. And I wonder if you think that the tone of the show was changed in a long-term way by those two things happening so close together, and, you know, one having a big effect on, you know, Letterman's health and his body, and the other having, you know, a huge effect on the city, our country, the world, and, of course, on the show.
You know, I think this show has evolved. I think the very early years with Meryl and all of those great writers.
And this is
her.
Meryl Marco, who's the first head writer for Letterman.
Yes,
right?
And it was pure innovation. It was turning television on its head. It was like nothing anyone had ever seen. Then the show evolved a little further when we went to CBS. The show moved to 11:30 and to a big theater. You could do less material that was kind of material for comedy writers only. You know what I mean? You had to appeal a little bit more to a mass audience. As the show has evolved beyond that, now we are in a phase where Dave, you know, the things you mentioned, the bypass, you know, the 9/11. But I think also as Dave has gotten older, mm-hmm. you know, if you look at most of the highlights of the show, they're actually not comedy highlights as much. I mean, we have plenty. There's a lot of smart people doing a lot of great things up there. But really, Dave has become, I think, as Tom Brokaw has gone away, as Dan Rather has gone away, as Peter Jennings unfortunately passed away, Dave is a lone trusted voice in broadcasting. And this is part of Dave's genius. And I can tell you that I felt the pains of this as head writer, when your instinct in desperation as you're putting on a show each night is that sometimes you want to go back to a certain well because things have worked and people love it. And Dave, through that honesty as a performer, says, no, I don't want to do that. And these kind of microscopic course corrections each day lead you to another place. And thankfully, then you're not 68 and still putting on a Velcro suit and jumping up on a wall. You know what I mean? So I think what you have now is Dave as this great broadcaster and great communicator. And interestingly, it's the same guy. If you go back to those early clips and you see him kind of tearing down celebrities that were putting on airs through that same honest reaction, it's now him reacting to bigger global events. It's a very interesting evolution of a man and an artist, I think.
There's another very sober clip that I want to play, and this is from a really personal thing that happened in Letterman's life when he was being blackmailed for having had affairs with women who worked on the show. And I think he was being blackmailed for like $2 million. The guy who was blackmailing him was threatening to make a movie about Letterman's affairs. And he went to the police. He tried to figure out what to do. And he so as not to give in to a blackmailer, he went public on the show in a monologue. And it was kind of a remarkable moment. Let's hear an excerpt of that. And this is from October 1st, 2009.
Now, of course, we get to what was it? What was all the creepy stuff that he was going to put into the screenplay and the movie? And the creepy stuff was that I have had sex with women who work for me on this show. Now, my response to that is, yes, I have. I have had sex with women who work on this show. And would it be embarrassing if it were made public? Perhaps it would. Perhaps it would, especially for the women. But that's a decision for them to make if they want to come public and talk about the relationships. If I want to go public and talk about the relationships, but what you don't want is a guy saying, oh, I know you had sex with women, so I would like $2 million, or I'm going to make trouble for you. So that's where we stand right now. I just want to thank the people at the Special Prosecution Bureau and the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, Robert Morgenthau, who is head of that. It's been a very bizarre experience. I feel like I need to protect these people. I need to certainly protect my family. I need to protect myself, hope to protect my job, and the friends, everybody that has been very supportive through this. And I don't plan to say much more about this on this particular topic. So thank you for letting me bend your ears.
So that's David Letterman coming out about his affairs. So that is such a very unique moment in television, in part because Letterman's talking about being blackmailed. He's confessing to affairs. Did you work on the monologue at all? Did he run it past you?
No. No. And it should be said that, you know, in all of these types of moments, the heart surgery, 9/11, things like this, whatever Dave will choose to say, that's all Dave. You know, that he doesn't even really tell us what he's going to say. You know, Dave is, to be crystal clear, this is not a guy in a suit that reads a prompter. This is a very smart, considered guy who knows exactly what he's doing at all times.
If you don't mind sharing this, how did David Letterman tell you that he was going to retire?
Well, he called a bunch of us into his dressing room right before the show, and there was maybe, eight of us in there, and said earlier today, I called Les Moonves and have decided that it's time, and then went out and said what he said on the air a half hour later. You know, I've worked at this show since I'm 23. It really is all I've known my entire adult life. It's pretty much been high school, college, and then The Late Show. It was very odd to hear that this was over, but I remember my gut feeling at the time, feeling like, you know what? He deserves this. You know, if whatever has brought him to this decision, you know, he's done it. You know, he has nothing left to prove. And if for whatever reason that he's made this decision, I'm happy for him.
Well, Rob Burnett, thank you for all the great television. And whatever this change in your life brings, I hope the next chapter is wonderful.
Thank you.
Rob Burnett spoke with Terry last Tuesday. Burnett has worked with David Letterman since 1985. Burnett's long run as the executive producer of The Late Show with David Letterman ended last Wednesday night with the finale.